This is an ABC podcast.
Ali Colquitt says the thing that woke her up from a bad spiral of self-destruction was getting arrested. Ali was making money dancing at the Butterbean Club in King's Cross when detectives turned up at her door just before Christmas in 2015 and arrested her for drug dealing. Ali spent 14 months in prison, and it was there that she got clean and began turning her life around. Step by step, she rebuilt how she saw herself, and she's now helping other young women do the same. Hi, Ali.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What memories do you have from when you were a little kid? What did home look like?
Oh, our home was pretty happy. We lived in the valleys of northern New South Wales, in between Coffs Harbour and Grafton. So it was a beautiful place to grow up. Very green, surrounded by nature. I had a home life that was both happy and idyllic. And at the same time, you know, our family had their problems just like every other family. There was alcohol. There was a lot of yelling. And, you know, I think looking back, a lot of undiagnosed mental health issues that were going on with my mom and probably my dad as well. And, you know, my sisters and I, we didn't have a place to take how we were feeling. It wasn't the type of home where you could go to your parents and say, hey, I'm having a feeling or I'm having an issue at school, or it just wasn't that type of environment. So you became self-reliant, you know, really, really young.
Did you spend a lot of time out in the bush when you were a kid?
Actually, no. My escape was I went inside myself. So, you know, even though I did run around in the bush and we got muddy and dirty and absolutely loved that with my sisters, my escape from what was going on around me was I withdrew into myself and also into art. I used to draw compulsively. My mum used to bring home rolls of butcher's paper. And she used to bring home, back in the day, they used to have the old form guides and TAB slips from the pub. They were on these coloured pieces of paper. And she would bring stacks and stacks of that stuff home from the pub. And I would just draw and draw and draw. And that was my escape. I was one of those kids that felt like I was always feeling too much. And it was just overwhelming. So art was my escape, I suppose. Yeah.
What was school like for you as a kid?
School was difficult. I've never really talked about this before, but publicly, but I actually had an abusive school teacher throughout my early primary school years. So from kindergarten through to grade five, I had a teacher who was physically abusive. And so I was in a lot of fear throughout my schooling. And then, you know, I would go home and there would be my dad who was a drinker and that would be fearful. And so I was in fear a lot of the time. So I look back now and I realize that I was very afraid all of the time. And I adapted to that environment as quickly and as best as I could.
Did that fear come up in your body in any way?
Yeah, it did. So I was sick a lot. I got diagnosed with asthma and they put me on all these different asthma medications and they put me on like the Intel and the Ventolin, the breathing machines and all this. And, you know, I didn't have asthma. You know, I had a lot of other stuff that came up, you know, I had the grommets and the adenoids and I had all the, like, I was always sick. And I think looking back, it was probably linked to my mental state more than anything. I had bedwetting and all that sort of stuff as well. Like a lot of stuff that I think child psychologists nowadays would be able to diagnose pretty quickly. But back then it was different.
Your family moved to Coffs Harbour for high school. What was high school like?
So by the time I got to high school, you know, I'd already developed a bit of a personality of I was an angry child. I used to use anger as a way to defend myself from the world that I found really scary and intimidating. I developed my mum used to call me precocious, so I don't really know. I was intelligent and I was loud and I was outspoken and I was angry. So I had all of those things going on. They were my defense mechanism against the world, but inside I was just a really afraid, anxiety-ridden child. And so high school, I got into a lot of fights. I got into fights with boys. I was getting dragged to the principal's office for fighting and, swearing and all this sort of thing. And then pretty early on, I discovered weed, marijuana, started smoking. And that was a real, I guess it was a way for me to calm myself and disconnect from everything that was going on around me. So I used to smoke a fair bit in high school as well.
What about drinking?
Yeah. So I think I discovered alcohol like pretty early on. Like my sisters and I would occasionally, you know, I don't know if this is something that people do, but we used to have sips of dad's beer when we were little. But like, I remember just loving the taste, loving it, you know, and every now and then dad would hand me a beer and I would just scull it, you know, and it was just, yeah, like I was always into alcohol. And then early teenage years, like maybe 13 or 14, I started drinking alcohol regularly. And my parents were pretty chilled. They weren't the sort of parents that were like, you can't drink. They were the sort of parents that were like, if you're going to drink, we'd rather you do it here so we can supervise you. And I think they were just doing the best that they knew how to do. But yeah, there was a fair bit of drinking going on.
Where did you get alcohol as a teenager?
My friends and I would hang out outside the bottle shop and find people and say, oh, can you go buy us a six pack of UDLs or whatever? And also I'd just steal it out of dad's beer fridge. Dad had a fridge that was always full of beer and I would just take it.
And what did alcohol do for you as a teenager? What would it change?
I heard someone describe the way they felt when they first drank, and it's the best description. It said, the first time I drank alcohol, I felt normal for the first time. And that's exactly how I felt. You know, the first time I got that alcohol buzz, I felt like I belonged and I felt like part of something. So for me, it was really, it became a solution to all of that internal yuck that was going on. When I drank, I felt like I could have friends and I could, you know, talk to the opposite sex and I could, you know, there was so many things that I could do that if I was sober, there was no way that I'd be able to do it.
After high school finished or you left school, where did you move to?
First, I went to Brisbane. So, yeah, I finished high school and I was quite a bright student. I was doing really well in high school, but by the end of grade 12, the alcohol had kind of taken over and that was all I wanted to do was just party and drink. And I moved to Brisbane. I enrolled in art school. I dropped out pretty soon after I enrolled because it was too difficult to study. You know, I had to pay rent and go to school and work. So I wasn't able to juggle all three of those things. It was just way too hard. I didn't have any help. So I decided to just quit and go and work.
And where were you living in Brisbane?
I was living in one of the places I lived was in South Brisbane, and it was like this condemned building. Like my one of the girls I met in school, we started renting this place, and it was like a squat. This place was just full of like using addicts, and there was like this building had been basically marked for demolition, and they told everyone to move out, but we just kind of stayed, and it was disgusting, but we loved it because we could just, you know, I remember throwing furniture off the balcony and, you know, lighting things on fire, and just, it was just an absolute disgrace, but, you know, we thought it was the best ever. It was very punk.
speaking of punk, how hard did you fall for your first boyfriend, Dale?
Oh, yeah, Dale. Yeah, pretty hard. So, by this point I had taken up the personality of a punk rocker, a nihilist, and I thought that was just the coolest thing ever, and I had the mohawk and everything.
What colour was your mohawk, Ali?
It was black. It was black.
How high?
It was pretty high. Like I used to use soap. That was my trick. So I learned that if you put soap and it's fairly dry, you can make it stand up on end. So I had this black mohawk and I used to wear the chains and all that stuff. I met a guy, my first boyfriend, Dale. I met him on the Gold Coast, and I think I just dragged him out of a pub somewhere and was like, well, you know, now I'm in love with you. And that was kind of how that went. But yeah, it was my first experience of having someone that reciprocated how I felt. I'd never really been someone who was interested in boys. I was kind of not really, I was more interested in getting wasted. Like my friends were all boy obsessed and I was kind of the girl that the guys would be friends with. I wasn't really the interest of any of the guys' affection. So, you know, when I moved away and I met Dale, it was pretty head over heels. Looking back, I can see that it was just, you know, obsession. And also, you know, I had a really insecure and low self-esteem. And so I'm feeling validated through this relationship, feeling really seen and feeling wanted. And it fulfilled a lot of things for me. So I fell pretty hard for him. Yeah.
And what happened to that punk you fell in love with?
Dale was a destructive guy. He was more messed up than I was, you know, so I think that's probably why I loved him so much. And unfortunately, he passed away. He committed suicide a few months actually after we broke up. And, you know, that devastated me. And this was before we had started that national conversation around suicide. It was actually really shocking for me to experience that, because I'd heard about it, but it just hit so close to home. And seeing the impacts that it had on his family as well was really heartbreaking. And just having someone that you love so much, they were there and then the next minute they weren't there. And I used to bring up his voicemail and just listen to his voice so I could hear it. So it was a really difficult time, and I had absolutely no skills or tools on how to cope with grief and loss. I had no skills or tools on how to cope with anything, but with something that big, the only thing I knew how to do was to drink. You know, my sister, she turned up at my house with some vodka and she gave it to me. And I think I was on the bathroom floor at this time, or the kitchen floor, just staring into space. And I was completely broken when he passed, and it kind of became like an excuse to just keep doing what I was doing, which was just completely write myself off. And, you know, I ran with that for a while.
As time's passed, how has your grief for him changed over the years?
You know, I couldn't talk about him, and I couldn't see photos of him, and I couldn't even think about him without it stinging. Like, it just stung, because I hadn't dealt with it and I didn't know how to deal with it. And later on, after coming into recovery and finally getting therapy and help, you know, I was able to process that grief, you know, 10 years later. And now when I talk about him and I think about him, it doesn't sting. It's just this nice feeling of, you know, oh, what a lovely experience in my life. And I can look back at him with fondness and kindness and love in my heart, and there's no sting there anymore. And that's the difference of processing that grief. It's actually such a healthy thing to do. And, you know, I just didn't know how to do that when I was younger.
How did he start dancing in clubs?
Yeah, after Dale's passing, my self-esteem hit like an all-time low. And I was dating guys who were just, I started dating guys who were really abusive. And one guy in particular who just really broke my spirit, he was like emotionally abusive, controlling, and we would be on and off again, you know. And the experience with him was, I just felt like there was just nothing left. Like I couldn't fall any further. And so I had a friend who was working in a club, and she got me the job behind the bar. And then it wasn't long before I moved from one side of the bar to the other side. And the girls used to say, don't do it. Don't do it. Because once you start, there's no going back. Like, because the money comes so quickly and so easily, and you become trapped. And I thought, oh, no, I'll handle it. It's like addiction, you know, I'll be right. And it was a way for me to get out of that horrible situation with that abusive guy. Like it was actually, I took this leap from being with him and being trapped in this cycle with him, and then I started dancing, and that got me away from him, and I started earning my own money, and I started not needing him, and I had all these, like, you know, people around me that were just like me. And I thought, this is cool, you know, this is really cool. I don't need him, I don't need anybody.
What about the dancing itself? Like, was that a real leap? Did you have to put on a kind of persona when you were at work, or did it come naturally?
No, it didn't come naturally. I'm a tomboy. I live in basically shop in the men's section. my partner and I joke about it because he thinks that I'm more blokey than him, and I'm just like a real tomboy. And yeah, like for me, going into that world was really eye-opening, because I actually developed a camaraderie with some of the girls, and they were so open, and they were so open with their sexuality and their womanness, that I found that really, really interesting. And I just soaked it up like a sponge, and they taught me how to do my hair and walk in heels and do makeup and how to manipulate men for money. And like, they taught me everything, and I thought that was just so cool and so empowering. And, you know, obviously at that point I had stars in my eyes. I didn't see the downside. I didn't see the dark side. I just saw a way to claim my power back.
What did you think of the guys who would come and see you dance?
I didn't really think much of them. You know, I didn't really put thought into it. They were just, for me, they were a dollar sign. I didn't really care, you know, who they were or anything. They were just a means to an end, you know, the clients. And I think they probably felt the same way about us. It was, you know, one way or another. You're just a client. You're just a dollar sign. And they would see us and go, you're just a stripper. You're just a pair of tits and an ass. And that's okay. You know, it's a transactional agreement.
You ended up working at a Sydney club called Bada Bing. How did that club compare to the other ones in King's Cross?
Well, actually, came back from the UK. I'd been dancing over in Europe and Spain and places like that. And then I came back to King's Cross and my friend and I were like looking for a place to work. It was actually the guy who was managing it. He was the most, I don't know the word, least sleazy. He was actually really, really nice, this guy. We went and spoke to him and he seemed like a really lovely guy. And I'm still friends with him. He's actually a really great guy. And he treated everyone with respect and he was like a protector with the girls. He wasn't exploitative. He was just a good, decent guy. And so that was the reason why we started working there.
And was it a more high-end club than some of the places?
Absolutely not. If anyone's been to Bada Bing, they know. It's actually like it was like a hip hop kind of vibe. They had a really amazing hip hop DJ there for years and years. So like, you know, a lot of rappers and stuff that would come from overseas would go to Bada Bing and it was the place to be on a Saturday night. And it was always really busy. It was really busy. Yeah.
You were also working as a tattoo artist. When did you first get into tattoos?
When I was 14 or so in Coffs Harbour, where we moved to, there was a tattoo store in Coffs called Coat of Arms. And if anyone's from that area, they'll know Arm. He's a bit of a legend in Coffs. And they had a tattoo studio in this alleyway down the street from my house. And I used to walk past and I'd just stick my head on the window and look in like a kid on a candy store. And I would just think that these people were just the coolest people. You know, they could draw dragons and like mermaids. And I just was in awe of their artistic abilities. And so I remember from the age of like 14, thinking that tattoo artists were the coolest people ever and wanting to do that, but not being able to think that it would ever be on my scope. But yeah, I managed to land an apprenticeship while I was working in the Cross. And I thought, yeah, this is my ticket out. This is how I'm going to get out of this crazy world. But obviously trying to juggle that life as well as start a new career, it did not work out. I was fucked. So I really feel for people who are trying to make that change, who are trying to get out, trying to claw their way out of something and they can see how they're going to do it, but they just can't get there. And that's what was happening for me as I was turning up to my apprenticeship, trying to put my 110% in, but I was absolutely knackered from work, from drinking, from drugs. And I just couldn't get there, you know? And, you know, when that apprenticeship ended, you know, they were really good about it. The owners of the shop, they kind of said, look, they could see that it wasn't going to work out because I was a mess. And when that ended, I kind of went really off the rails then. It's like I felt like my dream was slipping away, you know? Yeah.
How big a part did drugs play in that whole scene at the Cross?
It was pretty big. For me, it was a way to control my drinking because I was a full-blown alcoholic by this point. And if I used cocaine, I was able to stay coherent and the alcohol wouldn't take over. So I started using it regularly. And then unbeknownst to me, I developed a dependence and an addiction on that as well. You know, no one ever thinks they're going to be an addict. No one ever thinks that they're going to end up addicted. It doesn't work like that. Addiction happens to you. It's not something you choose. So it actually happens on a neurological level. So before you know it, you're acting like this insane person and you don't know why. It's because you need the drugs.
When you started selling Cocaine Alley, did it feel at the time like you'd crossed a line? Like, were you conscious of that?
No. I don't think there were many lines left to cross. You know, I did not think about me crossing a line. I was thinking about this is a really good way to get my hands on drugs and not have to pay for them. And girls that are addicted, there's a couple of things you can do. You can either do crime, you can do sex work, or you can sell drugs. And I didn't want to do sex work. You know, I had this invisible line of like, yeah, I'll, you know, let guys look at me and touch me, but I'm not sleeping with them. So I wasn't able to cross that line. And so selling drugs was what I was going to do to get the money that I needed and the drugs that I needed.
What text did you get from friends at the club in December 2015?
Yeah, raid, don't come in. That was the text. I got tipped off. I had a migraine, so I stayed home and I needed the money, so I was going to go to work. And then I just got this random text and it just said, yeah, four words, raid, don't come in. And I knew there was going to be a knock on the door. You know, I went and flushed all my drugs and I, you know, got everything out of the house. And yeah, then it was bang, 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 open the door. You want to come with us? And I sort of went, yep, pack my bag. Well, I didn't pack my bag. I grabbed my phone. At that point, still didn't realize that I wasn't going to come home. I still thought I would just go down there, everything would be okay, and I'd come home a couple of days later. But no, that's not what happened.
Was there a lot of press coverage of that arrest and that raid?
Yeah, you know, I found out a couple of days after my arrest when I finally got processed. I think I landed in Silverwater. That's when I found out that there'd been press. I finally got to speak to my family and I finally got to, you know, talk to some other people, and they said, you know, you'd been on the 6 o'clock news. They took your face. They took your Facebook photos. They, you know, they put you on the Daily Mail. I went on the, you know, UK Daily Mail, the Channel 7, Channel 9, like ABC. Like I was beside myself. I thought, how can they do that? Like, how are they allowed to do that? And they were calling me all this stuff. They were saying, like, you know, I was a sex worker and all this. And while that's technically true, it's just like, oh my God, my mom's going to read this. She's going to kill me. Like, so I was, there was some grace in it because I was locked up. I didn't have to be exposed to that. But my whole family, you know, my mum was getting calls from all these, you know, people. It was like that car crash in slow motion. Everybody wanted to slow down and look at it. And so my mum was having to kind of explain to people that had no idea that I'd been off the rails for years, what the hell has happened to Alison? Why is she in jail? Like, what's going on? You know, so I felt for my family. I felt awful. I felt like I'd put them through hell. I don't really care what they said about me. It was just sad that my family had to go through that.
When you were first taken in by the police, did they give you an idea of how serious the charges might be?
Yeah, so when I was being processed at Maroubra, that was when they wanted to do the interview, the police interview. And how it works is like they kind of interview you and they use whatever you say in the interview as evidence to kind of build a case. And luckily for me, I had been arrested once before in my life years and years and years ago when I was really early, really young, and the charges were dropped and I knew the process. And the process is don't talk, just don't say anything. You're not there to give them information, get a lawyer. So they went to interview me and I just clammed up and I said, I want a lawyer. And they basically said, yeah, that's fine. But, you know, these charges are serious. You're looking at 25 years for one of these charges and there's nine of them. And so I resigned myself to the fact that I was probably not going to see freedom for a long time.
You were also coming off drugs and alcohol. How was your body reacting to that?
Yeah, I was really unwell, you know, really sick. I didn't know that I was in alcohol withdrawal because I didn't really know that was a thing. I was having DTs, like they call them delirium tremens. It's like where your body shakes, and I was vomiting and I was having like weird auditory hallucinations and things like that. And this was all happening while I was induction, which is a wing of the jail that they put you in when they're processing you just as you arrive. And so there was me and a lot of other women who were experiencing the same thing.
Were you given any help, like medication or?
No. If you tell the prison guards that you're coming off alcohol or I think opiates, they will put you on Valium. They'll give you some medical assistance, but I didn't know that that's what was happening to me. So I actually didn't get any medical assistance. So it was really, really tough. I eventually did see the clinic, but not for a while later.
What's the term knocking up mean?
Knocking up. So that's a jail term. When you press the buzzer on the wall, it's basically if you need medical assistance or if you need something as an emergency, you're being attacked or someone's having a seizure or whatever, you knock up and that's the little red button you press and the officers are supposed to come and respond. But oftentimes they don't. And oftentimes if they do respond, it'll be a long time later. So, when I got really, really sick, you know, my cellie was knocking up for me and, you know, they didn't respond for quite a few hours. Eventually took me to the clinic and I got some medication and, you know, I got a bit better after that. But, that's what that is.
Did you ever have to knock up for someone else, Ali?
Yeah, I did. I had to knock up once when my cellie at Silverwater had tried to do her own tooth extraction with a razor, and she was bleeding all over the place, and she had one of the, like, they have like hospital blankets. Like in winter, they have like these hospital blankets, and she had one for some reason. But she had shoved this blanket in her mouth, and there was just blood everywhere. And it was just, it was a bit messy. And And I remember thinking, I said, oh, I'll knock up. And she's going, no, I'll be right. And I'm thinking, no, you're not going to be right. There's blood everywhere. And why did you do that? And she's like, oh, my tooth hurt. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this chick's insane. So yeah, it took a long time for them to respond to that as well. They finally came and got her and took her away. I think she went to the psych ward, to be honest. But yeah, it was pretty wild to experience.
What was day-to-day life like in jail?
Day-to-day, you know, once you get classified and you get processed and you get sent off to where you're going to be held, you can settle into day-to-day life. It does get a little easier. You know, I got classified as a Cat 3, which is, you know, semi-serious. They sent me off to Windsor, to Dilwinia, which is where they, that's the women's part of Windsor Prison. And day-to-day life is you get up at about, I think it's 7 a.m. You do muster where you line up. You've got to have your greens on. You've got to have your jail uniform on and your shoes on, and you all line up against the wall, and the officers will come in and they'll count everyone by saying their surname, and you respond like present or yes. And then they leave. Then you go have breakfast and get ready, and then you head off to work, and then you pretty much work till about 3, half past 3.
What was your official job in prison, Ali?
I had a couple of jobs, but I ended up, while I was in Dilwinia, I worked in the library. So I was working in the library and the education department. So that was a pretty good job, actually.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Ali, how did you go about making a bit of money for yourself while you were in jail?
Yeah, so I was actually drawing. Like, I remember early on when I was in Silverwater, someone gave me a pen, and I remember thinking, yes, like, now that I have a pen, it's going to be okay. Like, I can withdraw back into that world again. It was the same headspace as when I was a little kid escaping all the craziness. So I went into my little art world again, and I started drawing, and people were like, oh my God, you can draw. And I was like, yeah. And then, you know, every now and then someone would come up to me and say, hey, can you draw this picture of my kids? Or can you draw me a tattoo design or whatever? And once people realized I could do that, then I started to get bombarded with requests of art. And then I started charging people for it. And in jail, you don't charge money, you charge buy up, which is like the weekly food that you can buy. So yeah, I had this whole little business set up where I was like drawing things, and then people were paying me, and I even had people working for me.
Really? What sort of things? How did you have people working for you?
Well, I had so many requests for like drawings that I had one of my mates was like my runner, you know. I had a book and I had like the jobs in it and what they owed me. And then my mate would go and collect every buy up day. She'd go and collect all the things I was owed. And then she would like deliver the artworks, and then she would get more clients for me. And I was like running a full business. And the officers, they found the book and they pulled me in and they were like, what's this? And I said, oh, I'm just doing drawings. And they're going, bullshit. Like, they looked at my file. They knew I was in for drugs. They were like, you're dealing and all this. I said, no, I'm not. Like, who's going to have a book if they're dealing drugs? Like, that's dumb, you know. Anyway, they let me go. I didn't get in trouble for it, but they were like, just stop. And I didn't stop. But anyway.
You're running an art studio.
Oh, my God. I was like, if I can make this work in jail, I could be able to make a life out there for myself. Like, I can do this, you know. So that was kind of like a motivator.
And what food items were the most prized once you had those tickets?
everyone who's been in knows that chili tuna is like, I don't even eat meat, but chili tuna was the thing, you know, you get chili tuna, you get blocks of chocolate. For me, because I went vegetarian and all that, I wanted soy milk, I wanted kidney beans because that was where I was getting my iron from. Like, there was no fresh food or vegetables. There's no access to anything healthy. So I had to buy all that. Yeah. So, you know, for me, it was like I was stocking up on things that were going to keep me relatively healthy.
How important was reading or books for you when you were inside?
It was massively important. You know, they were everything. You know, I escaped back into myself, and reading was part of that too. I was just churning through books. I feel like I read the entire library at Dilwinia. And also watching how important books were for other women was really eye-opening. Like, you know, these are people that probably most of us, we were too busy running around being crazy on drugs and stuff. There's no way we would have taken the time to sit down, make a cup of tea and read a book. That's just not something that you do. So seeing women reading was really amazing. Like, everyone was reading, and they all, you know, a really, really good book was Hot Commodity. There was like a waiting list for a really good book. And I don't know if you've seen, but Bree Lee, she's an author. She wrote Eggshell Skull. She started an initiative, and we were able to support her with that through Women's Justice Network. And we're donating books directly to women in custody now. So through that initiative, she's been able to donate like over $10,000 worth of books from people in the community straight to women in jail. So that's the sort of amazing stuff that we're able to do now. So when members of the community buy a book from Glee Books, then they can donate one. And it's just been so amazing, because I know that that's actually going to impact the women in jail directly. And it's a very cool thing, like full circle moment. Yeah.
After those months in prison of not drinking or taking drugs, how were you feeling physically? What had changed?
I started to hear things like the birds, and I started to notice things like the sky was really blue and the trees were really green. And, you know, people who've been in alcohol and drug addiction and then they get sober, they talk about the fog lifting. And I had that experience, like this visceral experience of like being able to smell and to taste and to see things. It was amazing, because I didn't realize how numb I had been. It's about 3 month mark that happens, about 90 days in, the fog lifts. And then, yeah, it was pretty cool. And I must have looked insane. You know, I was walking around the prison yard going, God, it's so beautiful in here. Like, wow, you know. Just, yeah, they must have thought I was insane, surely.
And what about emotionally? Who in prison helped you start to understand your emotions differently?
There was a few things that happened. You know, I put myself into the drug program in jail, which is called IDAPT. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to complete that because I was on remand. So there's not, you know, there's that. But there was a woman who came in from Mount Druitt TAFE, and she would come in, and I'm pretty sure she was just volunteering her time to teach us like this little TAFE course. And for the first time in my life, you know, someone spoke to me about like the importance of emotional resilience, because I didn't know what it was. And I couldn't figure out why I had dealt my life so badly. And then, like, you know, my sisters who grew up in the same home as me, they were doing okay. Like, I didn't understand how, like, why do I keep fucking up? Like, what's wrong with me? You know, and this woman, she said, no, that's called resilience. Like, some people have more resilience and others don't. And that's okay. It just means you need to build some resilience, some emotional resilience. And I thought, oh, that's amazing. You know, and I got really interested in that psychological side of addiction and the emotional side of it.
And how did you go about starting to build resilience, build it like a muscle?
Well, it wasn't until I got out of prison that I was able to really start that journey, because in custody you just don't really have it very many opportunities. There is no counselling, there's no psychologist. Oh, there is a psychologist, but you can't really make an appointment and just go see the psychologist, because there's like 300 women and one psychologist. So, and it's also seen as weakness, so it's not really something that you do. But yeah, like I started to build my emotional resilience when I got out of custody.
Did you spend much time while you were in prison thinking about life outside, what that might look like when you got out?
I used to sort of fantasize about, you know, starting over. Like my life had been completely burned to the ground. It was almost like this weird freedom, you know, when you've got nothing left. I've got no possessions. I've got no lease. I don't have a home. I've got nothing. Pretty much everyone that used to be my friend has fallen off the face of the earth. And there's a freedom in that. So I was able to start my life from scratch. What do I want to do? How do I want to impact people? You know, and there was a few people that I'd spoken to who inspired me, you know, women who seemed like they were really strong and emotionally resilient. And they were, I don't know how to describe it. They were like just ordinary people that just cared about others, like with their whole heart. And I found that really beautiful. Like the first time, one of them was actually the chaplain in the prison. And I just thought, like, why do you give a shit about us? I just thought that they were they were like angels, you know, these people. And I thought to myself, I want to be like that. I want to be that for someone else. Like, I want to be able to, you know, reach out to someone when they're at their lowest and just let them know that someone cares. And like that inspired me to change my life. Like it just completely, I just wanted to start from scratch, find out what I have to do, go and study or do whatever I have to do to get well, and then go and do whatever course I need to do so that I can be that for somebody else.
How long did it take for your case to get to court?
I spent 14 months on remand, which is crazy, especially for the charge that I was charged with. It wasn't that serious. Like it was an ongoing supply charge, which is a fairly serious charge, but it's not for that amount of remand time. I just got caught in the system, and this is before COVID. This was like before COVID. So it was like adjournment. And then, you know, finally got in front of the judge and he gave me two weeks to serve. Yeah. Which was crazy.
Was anyone there to meet you when you were released?
Yeah. So, my mum and my sister came and met me when I was released. Yeah. It was a pretty wild moment. Like I had processed a fair bit of stuff and I had gone through this experience and come out of it a different person. Jail changes you. You don't go in and then come out the same person. Like it actually changes you. And so it was weird. Like I had some resentment towards my family. I had some unresolved issues. I knew I needed help. But my mum and my sister came and met me and they dropped me at the refuge that I was going to be living at. My mum and my sister don't live in Sydney, so I wasn't able to stay with family. So I went and stayed at a homeless shelter in Redfern, and that was where I was going to be living for the next few months.
Things had changed for you so much on the inside, as you say. How scary was it actually being on the outside?
It was terrifying. Like I'd never been sober as an adult, like in the world. And I had the emotional intelligence of like a 12-year-old. So, you know, it was really scary. You know, the woman who ran the refuge, like I remember asking her permission to go out and get a kebab for dinner because I didn't know if I was allowed to leave or not. And she laughed at me and she's like, of course you can go out. And I was like, oh, they thought it was really funny. But like, then I had to mentally psych myself up to go and get this kebab from up the road, you know, and I did it. I went up, I ordered, I got my falafel. I came home and then, I was like, oh God, that was so full on. Like, you know, just doing that was such a huge deal that I had to mentally prepare and then wind down after it. Like it was really full on.
Did it seem, Ali, like that the world was full of people who were somehow managing to live day-to-day lives while just ordering a kebab was so extreme?
Yeah. This is that PTSD that they talk about with people. Like you're in the world and you're looking around and people are just going about their day-to-day commute and they're going about their day-to-day lives and they're, you know, they're ordering food and they're doing their grocery shopping. And I was just staring at them thinking, like, how the fuck are you doing this? And why aren't you more concerned? Like it just seems so easy for everyone else. And I found even the most basic things so difficult. It was exhausting.
You'd managed to detox in prison and were clean. Why did you still want to go to rehab?
I got out of custody and I was really afraid that I was going to drink because I had this deep knowing that, you know, if I drink, I'll die. But I also knew that I couldn't cope. I had no no tools, no resilience, you know, on board. So I actually met a lady in custody and she said to me, when you get out, you need to go to meetings. And I was like, what the hell is that? She said, they're like AA, NA, like you need to go to meetings. That's where you're going to meet other people like you and you'll be able to survive. And so I think I was out for about 10 days and something happened. I know someone might have looked at me funny or I had some sort of emotional experience. And the only thing I knew how to do was to drink. So I thought, I'm going to drink, you know, this is what happens. You get triggered by something and the only coping skill you have is to drink. So I freaked out. I went and sat in my room. And then that night I decided to take myself to an AA meeting. And my first ever meeting, Redfern, Wednesday night, I went down to the meeting. I went in. It was just this room full of old dudes. And I thought, this is not for me. Like, what the hell? I don't belong here, you know? And you know, I sat down and the first guy got up and shared, he started talking. And as soon as he started talking, I realized that this is where I belonged. Like he described the way I felt. And that was the first time I'd ever heard another human describe it the way that I felt. It was remarkable, you know. And then I just stuck around and I was able to find support through those meetings that I needed. I still go to them today. So, yeah.
Where else were you getting help after you were on the outside?
Well, it was about that time when I realized that I needed help and that I wasn't going to be able to survive without drinking. So I went and banged on the door of this rehab in Glebe. There are women's and children's rehab, and I'd actually been recommended to them by the same woman in jail who told me about the meetings. And she said, you won't survive anywhere else. You need to go to this rehab because I know you and you won't survive anywhere else. So I went to this rehab and they made me come back a bunch of times before they finally took me in. And the lady, she said to me, you know, you've been sober for 14 months. Why do you need rehab? And I was like, because I'm going to drink and I'm insane. Like I need help. You know, I can't live out there. I can't survive out there. The world is too hard, you know? And I'm like a toddler in a grown-up's body trying to survive in the world. And if I want to stay sober, I need this. So they took me in and I was there for just over 2 years, actually. Yeah, long time.
How did those AA meetings and other rehab help change the way you saw yourself and what had led you to that point?
What they did was they broke down to the bare bones and they explained to me that, like, you're not a defective person. You're not a bad person. You are a sick person. You're a person with an illness. Your illness is called addiction. You know, you've probably got mental health stuff going on too, which we sorted out. But they actually, for the first time in my life, I felt like there's not something wrong with me. I'm just suffering from an illness and it's treatable. And so that was huge for me. It was absolutely massive. Like for the first time, I was able to start to build some self-esteem because prior to that, I felt like I was just this horrible, selfish person who just fucked up everything that I touched, you know? And so, yeah, it was really, really impactful when they taught us that. And so once you take the kind of responsibility away, you're able to then, you know, work on getting better. And so I just soaked up as much information as I could. I wanted to learn everything about my brain, how my brain was different to regular people, how I could rewire it, how I could learn resilience and build my self-esteem. And ultimately, the goal was to get well so that I could help others. Like I wanted to get as well as I possibly could. I wanted to get straight A's in rehab. You know, I was like the gold star student. I'm like, give me all the straight A's, you know. Once I realized that I wasn't a bad person, it was like, I can do anything.
So what are you doing now? If your motivation was to help other people, how are you doing that?
Well, I actually run a program for youth, for young women who are in jail. It's called Healing From Within. And we go into the youth prisons and I do art and creativity with them. And we have women who've got lived experience with all different types of things like prison and addiction, all kinds of like domestic violence and basically overcoming any challenging situation in life. And we bring these women in and they inspire the girls. They tell their stories and we do like lots of creative activities. And we also link the girls in with mentors. And just support them throughout their prison journey and when they get out. And that program been running for the last 2.5 years, but that obviously has been interrupted due to lockdowns and whatnot. But yeah, we're still doing that. And we also run another program in the community out in Blacktown. And that program's for young women who are in the community who are struggling with, you know, they might be in contact with the police, or they might be just having mental health issues, or that maybe they've got stuff going on at home. And we just created a space for young women to come and just feel part of something, feel heard, feel seen. Creativity and art is kind of the thing that joins us together. But the themes that we cover are very broad. You know, we basically tried to create a space that a young woman could come and feel part of something, build her emotional resilience, build her self-esteem, build her confidence, and trying to give these young girls, you know, what I didn't get, I suppose. Yeah.
You've also got back into tattooing. How did that happen?
Yeah. So, oh my God, like I wasn't able to get my tattoo license back, you know, when I got out of custody. I applied for it and they basically said no. So in New South Wales, you need to have a license to tattoo. And if you are deemed, the term that they use is not a fit and proper person to hold a tattoo license. So I was given a letter saying that I'm not a fit and proper person because of my criminal record, which, you know, shattered me. And then about 6 months later, I decided to try again. I got off parole and I thought, I'm going to give it another shot. I don't think it's that easy. It's actually not easy to get a tattoo license with a criminal record. But I appealed and I wrote a really good letter and I got all my references together. And I thought, no, like, I'm going to give this a shot because this is my dream, you know. And they gave it to me. They gave me my license. So and my partner and I. So I've got engaged as well. And my partner and I are opening a tattoo studio at the end of the month.
That's fantastic news! Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
What's it like tattooing people? What kind of stories do you hear?
I get to combine my love of art and creativity, and I also get to meet the most amazing people. And there's something that happens when you're getting tattooed, and I don't know whether it's like, I guess, part of the ritual of it, because it's been around for so long. Tattooing's thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, but people feel like they just start to open up. They just start to tell you their stories, and they just start to really get vulnerable. And I feel really privileged to hear stories, people tell me about what this tattoo means to them, why they're getting it. You know, a lot of the time it's a tribute, or it's to mark a really important part of their life or an event that happened. And so I feel really privileged to kind of combine the things that I love into this role and work for myself as well. It's brilliant.
It strikes me, Ali, that you had so many years not trusting yourself, but as a tattoo artist, people trust you completely. They're trusting you to mark their skin permanently.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, my self-doubt held me back my whole life. You know, the world was out there for the taking and I couldn't grab it because I just didn't have the confidence or the self-belief to go and grab it, you know. And so now, you know, living in my kind of, I don't know, self-actualized reality that I'm in now, it's pretty remarkable. And I feel very privileged to my clients and my friends that have let me tattoo them, that they're walking around with my art on them. It's a spinning art. It's a total spinning art, but I absolutely love it. I love it so much.
Ali, I so appreciate you sharing your story on Conversations. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you for having me. It's been really a huge privilege and I appreciate it a lot.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.